episode 36 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. Well, one lawyer anyway. I am alone from among the Steptoe lawyers, so I had to recruit an additional lawyer from my guest today. The guest commentator is Admiral David Simpson, chief of the FCC's Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau. Admiral Simpson has 20 years or more of information and communications technology experience supporting DOD before he went over to the FCC. And he is joined, as I said, by his chief counsel for cybersecurity in the Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau, Cleet Johnson. Welcome, Cleet. And I've known Cleet since he was on the Intelligence Committee staff, so I was glad that he could join us and hopefully add a little something to some of the legal news we talk about, and then to our discussion about the Public Safety Bureau. So let me get to the news. This week in NSA, boy, it is getting thin. I'm sure NSA is delighted that it's not making news every week. And the only news that it made this week that I could see was the decision to name Ann Neuberger as the chief risk officer. She's a very able woman. I've known her for quite a while. She used to work in the Pentagon on the enduring security framework, if I remember right. And so I'm sure she'll do this well. I have to say that when I read the description of the chief risk officer, it sounded to me like she was in charge of saying, well, that'll get you in trouble, and that'll get you in trouble, which, of course, is the inclination at NSA these days anyway. So when I see her next, I will tell her that I'm afraid her real title is going to end up being the chief risk aversion officer, and that we'll have a risk-averse NSA for 5 years or more, which would be too bad. But that's it. Yep.
You know, Stuart, and I know Ann from my prior background. You couldn't pick a better person for that job. She is technically competent. She's focused on the mission. She really understands this area. But she's also one who will speak truth to power when that's required. So I don't think they could have selected a better person for that position.
And she's not an NSA lifer.
Absolutely.
And there are very few people at the top of the agency who are not NSA lifers. While that offers many strengths, it's not adaptive when you've got a big problem with the outside world. It's a place that's wonderful at what it does, but would be just as happy if it never had to interact with anybody in Congress or the White House other than to bring them intelligence that made them say, wow.
That's right. And she understands IT at its core, so I'm really excited. I think she's going to do a good job there.
Great. All right. Other legal developments, the circuit courts are still struggling with this question of what Riley, or at least the emanations and penumbras of Riley, mean about location data and other things. The Fifth Circuit, came out with a surprisingly sensible after what the 11th Circuit result here, saying, come on, you have to give the cell that you're in touch with your location so that it can send the phone calls to you. And that kind of information is clearly shared with a third party. And under existing law, Smith against Maryland, you don't have a Fourth Amendment interest in a warrant there. They also said that violating the Stored Communications Act, even if there was one, doesn't result in the suppression of evidence, which I thought was a little surprising but sensible. So not everybody is taking the hint from the close decisions in the recent privacy cases in the Supreme Court and trying to get ahead of the court. So we'll see. This means there's going to be conflicts in the circuits, and the court will get to address this. Let me talk about, since take advantage of the fact we've got people who understand some of these security issues at a technical level, some things that are not directly legal, although they're going to end up legal, I suspect. Two or three things. Apple, it turns out, recent stories suggest that Apple knew for 6 months or so that, there were weaknesses that would allow people to engage in, brute force attacks on, their customers', passwords. And it's not surprising. You know, the trying to stop brute force attacks requires a lot of effort. You've got to make sure that you've found ways to slow people down and to, kick them out when they have too many bad guesses. And apparently somebody found a way around that, and told Apple about it, which, may well have, led to the later celebrity nude photo, disclosures. I'm not sure that there's something that we can say other than this is going to increase the likelihood of a lawsuit, because now there's a basis for saying that Apple acted irresponsibly or negligently in not being faster to close the gap. Telecom is full of situations where you have to provide passwords that people do not want to make really long because they have to log on all the time. Has the FCC struggled with this question of what do you do about protecting passwords against brute force attacks?
Well, it really is an area that isn't just the FCC's to oversee. You know, the FTC has done some really good work in this area, and I think that there's plenty of jurisdictional room for both to be working on this. The protection of passwords and more technical credentials between machines is a real challenge and very important if you're going to stop the kinds of attacks that you described. And it's something that there are so many interactions between computers and between individuals with their computing environment that one size does not fit all for password policies. And that's where we really think that you need individuals and organizations need to go through a risk calculus that says, well, what information am I protecting? And is it worth slowing down my access to that information to have stronger password policies or authentication policies associated with that exchange? So that's one of the reasons why we believe that it's not helpful for the government, for the regulators to prescriptively define, well, this is what you need to do regarding passwords.
That would be out of date in 6 months.
Oh, absolutely. So the right thing, however, I think, is for the market to expect that organizations have a risk management program associated with authentication between machines, but also authentication for their consumers. And so in that regard, we really are challenging our regulated entities to step up, show us what you're doing in that regard. It's the right thing for you to do. You need to protect this aspect of your market share anyway. If you want to avoid us getting more prescriptively into your knickers for this, then have a program that's going to reduce risk in the authentication arena and to ensure that there are elements of that that are transparent to us so that we recognize that the increased threat in this area, the clear attacker goal of exploiting through passwords and other authentication, you're closing those gaps.
Yeah. In this case, I suspect that the users, in many cases, didn't even know that they had uploaded these photos. And there's some question about whether iCloud just kind of said, oh, yeah, do you want to upload everything? And people may not have paid too much attention to what everything might involve, because you'd probably want well, if you were Kate Upton, at least a pretty strong encryption on your and password on your nude photos. The rest of us, you know, if you want to look at them, it's your lookout. All right.
Stuart, I would like to have one more comment on that. And that's that mobile devices today, part of the business model is to encourage self-synchronization of your digital life when right. you buy a new device, when you download a new application. And it's not clear all the time to consumers what they're agreeing to.
It couldn't possibly be.
Where the information will be stored. And we do believe that there needs to be improvement there. And we recently challenged two of our FACAs.
Your advisory committee.
Right? Thank you. Consumer Advisory Committee and the Technology Advisory Committee with teaming up. We've asked the Consumer Advisory Committee, and they said, yeah, we want to work on this, to develop the list of questions that consumers are cared about, do care about in privacy and security, and do so in a way that they can be asked that once in a consistent format,
right.
and don't have to, if they have an Apple device or if they switch from their tablet to their mobile phone to their PC, have to interpret in their own minds what that new language looks like. So the CAC will develop the consistent list of privacy and security questions. They will then pass them off to the TAC. And the TAC under Paul Steinberg is working on how, if we have that consistent articulation of the questions consumers want to be asked about privacy and security, do we map that in a way that evolves?
Oh, that app developers can just grab and use, right?
Right. So that the translation for making sure that that communicates to the app, the right intended selection that a consumer has made, is done without changing the questions.
That's interesting. I would have thought that in some ways, Apple and Google have a strong interest in this and have done some regulation. With Google, now, when I get an Android app, my sense is there's a fairly standard set of disclosures, that Google requires people in their app store to put on their app about what they're going to have access to. And I'm kind of always astonished when these silly little apps feel the need to, know my location and all my friends, but they do.
Right. So, that's presented to you on an app by app basis, right? Right? And invariably, most of us are just looking at the functionality. You went to the app store.
Yeah,
to go
exactly.
Get. And the fact that, there's a couple other icons there that I've got to allow it to have access to those things. If you've broken the code on what that means to where your photos are stored, I think you're way advanced than mere mortals. So flipping it around and having the ability to answer the questions the first time, and then when you download an app, reveal the question you answered here, do you want your photos anywhere else but your device? That it's tripped that trigger, that going further with the configuration of this app will in fact cause you to have to change that your answer to that question.
So that's interesting you talked a little bit about the FTC earlier and the jurisdictional divide. This one's got to be in territory that both the FTC and the FCC think is their responsibility. The apps are—they're not uniquely telecom. They run on phones, but they're not part of being a common carrier. It's obvious that the FCC should care a lot about that, but the FTC could just as easily say, "Well, do what you want, FCC. We're going to have our own privacy rules."
Sure, and I think that the rules are the FTC. Is it more appropriate for them to work on any kind of enforcement in that kind of area?
Their specialty is enforcement without any rules.
Yeah, exactly. Our specialty, I think, is predictive engagement with the market that we regulate to help address problems before they become problems.
Right.
And that's where the voluntary participation of the industry in the CAC and the TAC, I think, is well suited to handle that issue, because it's an issue with mobile devices, and mobile devices increasingly are how we communicate. So what the kinds of second order and third order effects from that communication absolutely are an interest area of ours, not taking away at all from the FTC's need to ensure that consumers aren't taken advantage of, that you don't have fraudulent claims, by device manufacturers or providers.
Right.
Did I get that right?
I think that's absolutely right. There are two different ways to see kind of overlapping jurisdictions or jurisdictions that share some of the same space. One is not the way we see it, and that is that there's a conflict. And that agencies bump up against each other and they fight and jockey over jurisdiction. The way we see it is the opposite of that, which is complementary and more of kind of a gears working together in order to create the strongest consumer protections that can exist. The FTC has certain very strong enforcement mechanisms and the FCC has the FTC's cut across the board, and the FCC is more obviously more specifically focused on the communications sector. But there are some important privacy considerations baked into the security considerations that we're focusing on. I'm sure we'll talk.
Sure,
And there's a clear distinction between the authorities that both commissions can bring to bear, but also the structure of the processes. So I think if you're going to proactively be working to regulate, to address issues before they become debilitating, you want to be very transparent in that. You want to ensure that all stakeholders in the ecosystem have an opportunity to engage. And that's how the FCC is set up. It's different at the FTC.
Right.
There's a lot that's closed door there, and it's appropriate for their reactive when it failed. We're going to make sure that you realize you failed the consumer in that regard.
So to sum it up, the FCC is in charge of trying to see problems before they are fully realized in the market and providing helpful advice to companies about ways to avoid those problems. And the FTC just comes in and shoots people afterwards for not following your advice.
Stewart's character.
That's my characterization, yes.
not the position of the FCC.
So the other big news of the week was shell shock, which probably, even though, I'm inherently suspicious of bugs that have their own acute name, and Heartbleed being the first of them, I haven't seen that Shellshock has its own logo yet. But actually, this one looks really serious because it's a flaw in Linux. It's been there for 20 years or more, right in a fundamental little utility called Bash. When I use a Linux machine, Bash is everywhere. We've gone to a system in which every Android phone runs on Linux. Most of Apple's computers run on Linux. We bought into the idea that, of course, open source code is carefully scrutinized because everybody can look at it, so it shouldn't have any bugs. But obviously, that was wrong. It's no more fun to look for bugs in open source than it is in proprietary, and it turns out there aren't a lot of people doing it. So my question is, one, does this change our view about the security of open source in a fundamental way? And two, just how serious is this, especially for telecommunications gear?
Well, it's a great question, and to the first, I don't think it's necessarily a change in at least professionals' perception of Linux and more broadly the security of open source software. You do get that nice crowdsourcing around open source software, but for the longest time within DoD, we recognized that you're only as good as the last crowdsourced round, and we early on had a secure version of Linux, SE Linux, which we
operated in a more controlled way for the kinds of applications that we would use Linux in. So I don't think the shortcomings of open source software were universally not well understood by professionals, but more broadly, and maybe this is kind of bring awareness to, you can't rely on that alone,
right,
to ensure that you're protected. That doesn't mean, however, that this means that open source won't have a place in the future, because there are so many good things from that large volume analysis of vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I'm with you that open source, it just has to happen. Because trying to get proprietary systems for everything is just not going to work. Better to have some open source system that is watched pretty carefully, like Linux now is, than to try to do proprietary systems. But I wonder, I mean, I assume that this is getting fixed pretty fast. I see Ubuntu has already done an update that fixes it. I assume that there's a patch for Android, but frankly, I'm not sure that I've seen any over-the-air updates on that. But now that we're using Linux in the Internet of Things, where it's much harder to upgrade whatever was installed, I wonder if we don't have a pretty serious structural problem with shell shock.
Well, I think it illuminates the importance as we go forward of agility, that you really have to pay attention to, and I'll just use the divisions that are used in the NIST cybersecurity framework. You know, you've got to have an identification, mm-hmm, part of your operation. You've got to have a detect, a protect, a respond, and a recover a part of cyber for any organization that for which information technology is an inherent part of their operations. And if you don't have that and can't be agile in that, you're going to be extremely vulnerable and potentially not be able to respond in a time frame that will keep your company from having very negative harm to the company and to the consumers that use that company. So I think that use of open source software means that if you're going to use it, you accept the risk. And your mitigation is that agility to go from identify to respond and recover.
Yeah, and it probably, you know, as we think about what the supply chain is on some of these things, we have worried mainly about foreign governments getting into the supply chain. But frankly, we should begin asking the question, do we have fundamental utilities on, you know, on which we depend that are maintained by a guy, you know, from 5 to 11 at night after he finishes his job at 7-Eleven. That's, you know, there's a lot of that in open source, and we probably should know that, and there should be a general principle that somebody who's got a few more resources than that should be at least exercising some kind of mentoring role in those areas, because we saw that with Heartbleed, we saw that here. There's a lot of stuff that people did because they volunteered for it, and their interest in maintaining it or fixing it fast might be a lot less than the consumer's interest.
Well, yes, and it's classic risk exposure, right? And if you just work to address that risk after the vulnerability arrives on scene, you know, the new attack, right, exploit, then you're really constraining yourself to a very narrow set of tools about that. So risk exposure starts with your dependency, your interdependency on different software modules, different code, and the ability for a given company to understand that supply chain as a risk to be managed, and the linkage to choices made there too, that that risk exposure, I think, is critical. But similarly, as you then design your workforce, determining whether or not you're going to have those skills organically within your company, that guy in 7-Eleven who's going to do that at night, may not be the right, person to cover that area for a given company, and it may be something that they really shouldn't do organically and should outsource.
No, it's something, you know, the Open Software Foundation, people like that who maintain these things probably need to start asking questions about when a component is really widely used, and the consumers are the big companies that are consumers are deeply dependent on it. They should be asking questions about, well, who actually maintains this, and how much in the way of resources does he really have? And if he doesn't have enough resources, go looking for a volunteer among the companies that depend on it. DoD wouldn't obviously undertake to fix all of this or to support all of the utilities, but I could imagine DoD saying, yeah, if there were 10 other institutions just like us, IBM and Microsoft and, Oracle, all of whom have dependence on some open source, and we divided up the responsibility for the utilities that need more support than they have now, you know, we'd take on two or three and others could take on two or three. I wonder if that isn't, maybe it's already happening, but it makes sense to start focusing on that, I suspect.
Well, I think that's a great point, Stuart. And while I don't have knowledge on the particular bash effort right now, you just go back to the Y2K and how DoD worked with the private sector to remediate that. You know, DoD has bases, runs housing developments, has utilities, puts out fires, it has all of the key functions that are out there in the rest of society that it has to be responsible and accountable for. So when things like this happen, to have the federal government work through public-private partnerships to respond rapidly, I think is the hallmark of what we have done well in this country around big problems.
So let me turn to something a little more hopeful, which is the financial industry has announced that they're actually launching a real-time information sharing system, which seems to have gotten a fair amount of support from the government, but it looks like a private sector effort, and it's 'cause the Financial Services Information Sharing Advisory Council has been, or maybe that's the Industry Sector Advisory Council, but in any event, they've been doing information sharing by sending, PDFs to each other, which is not exactly real time. And this seems to have been a privately organized effort to actually have that information shipped around electronically and in real time. It's called Sultra. I don't know if you followed that, or have an idea what it might mean for the telecommunications industry, but it struck me as exactly what was envisioned in CISPA and CISA, the statutes that have been or the bills that have been awaiting floor votes, at least CISA is. Do you have some sense about how much of a guide to the future this is?
I'm very excited about what's happening here. I think it's just the right thing that information sharing for it to be effective, it shouldn't just be government to private sector. In fact, I think that the bulk of it to really be effective should be private sector to private sector.
And when we talk about private information sharing, it seems to me that the critical thing is to share information about bad IP addresses, bad email addresses, the signatures for malware that people have discovered. Those are the things that you need to know right now because you can screen for them.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And not all of that needs to, in fact, be worked through government. And the timeline is best served by removing layers that don't need to be there.
Why does government need to be involved in that? I mean, government is a consumer. Government may have information, but they are not necessarily more likely to find a piece of malware than Citibank, are they?
I agree entirely. In fact, I think if you look at, well, the what am I going to do about it thing, if you constrain yourself to, if the banking sector finds some IP addresses, which in fact are threatening banking operations, to then constrain your options around, well, I've got to do something broadly to all those IP addresses for the rest of the internet, or I can't do anything at all, quite dramatically narrows what can be done around that. But if you look at the threat to banks from a section of IP addresses or a specific malware and look at their consumer relationship with the communication sector, I think you can then have something that is very narrowly organized around communication sector as you support banks on our behalf because we're buying services from you. Do this for information, for packets intended for my banks.
So this makes perfect sense that the banks are going to start saying, you need to join this, you, my telecom provider, need to join the, Sultra, and you need to then not only join, but you need to do something, and we'll tell you exactly what we want you to do. If an IP address shows up as, engaged in DDoS, we want you to suppress it at source or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't think the comm sector has to join Sultra to do that.
Okay.
But I do think the comm sector needs to have a Sultra equivalent, so that rapid machine-to-machine exchange around the problem, can occur. And then the two sectors work on the business rules to ensure that there's the right control and visibility into the concerns and the mitigations that develop from that. So that's why we've been working closely with the comm sector on measures like STIX and TAXI, which are the DHS actually started the protocols to support the classified exchange of that kind of a data, of that kind of threat data, real-time threat data, so that they can then have the physical exchange of the data not be the impediment to getting something done about it. That then becomes a business decision between the two sectors that we can start to work to identify if there are liability bearers, barriers around a specific use case. Work with us, work with the regulators in the banking sector to figure out how do we get past the required information sharing to handle things like a targeted DDoS attack on banks that we should be able to do more from the comm sector with.
Okay. I want to come back to that because that's a big part of what you've been doing. Let me wrap up the news discussion since we've moved over into policy pretty clearly with a couple of additional items. Google is under assault with a massive wiretapping claim against them, claiming that every single Wi-Fi broadcast that they picked up on their Street View cars was an illegal wiretap, and the courts thus far have refused to throw out the case. It's now moved into discovery. It's fascinating. There's hundreds of gigabytes of data that those cars picked up. Now the question is, of the 22 plaintiffs who claim that they've been wiretapped, can they find anything that belongs to them in those hundreds of gigabytes of data? Because if they can't, you know, they don't have a claim because they weren't wiretapped. And then if they don't have a claim, there is no class action. So this massive liability, one that's even bigger than Google's gross revenue, is hanging fire on a discovery dispute about how people are going to go through hundreds of gigabytes to see if they can find anything that looks like theirs. Good chance that that will kill the case because it's going to be pretty hard, I think, for the plaintiff's lawyers to figure out what they should be looking for and then to find it and then to find something that wouldn't be broadcast by anybody, even a Wi-Fi system that isn't encrypted. So that is a discovery dispute that bears watching. Russia has responded to U.S. And European sanctions by saying, gee, you think you can sanction us? We can make life miserable for your tech companies by moving forward the data localization requirement that Twitter and Facebook and Google all have to adopt, which means that they have to keep all of their Russian customers' data in Russia, in Russian data centers, which will come with their own security issues. That now is supposed to happen on January 1 of 2015, if the legislation that's now making its way through the rubber stamp parliament passes, as it almost certainly will. So if you thought there was going to be a crisis there in 2016, it's now 2015. And finally, Apple's canary has died.
In a coal mine?
Yes, more or less. Apple did something that has been widely described as a warrant canary. They're not allowed to tell people when they get a 215 order saying produce this information because there's a gag order built into it. And they won't, but they, since they hadn't received one in 2013, they were happy to put in their regular 6-month report the statement, we have never received a 215 order. And they figured they could say that for as long as that was true, but that when they took it out, everybody would notice and would realize that a 215 order had been served on them, something that made it difficult for them to be charged with violating the gag order, but communicated the fact that they'd gotten the order. And now it turns out that although people didn't notice right away, the last two reports have not included that statement. So it appears that Apple did get a 215 order. I wouldn't be surprised, frankly, if I had seen that in their transparency report and I were in government, I might have said, let's just send them a 215 order for my data, then, just so they can't say that anymore. So maybe they just got a 215 order for some random piece of information. They are now saying they've never received a 215 order for bulk data. But as an experiment in signaling, I'm not sure it's a great success, but it is indicative of the relationship between tech companies and the federal government on electronic discovery issues. So now let's jump into the Public Safety Bureau. Admiral, you've been talking a lot, but why don't I give you a chance to tell the listeners a little about how you got to where you are and what the Public Safety Bureau does.
Well, Stuart, it's a great question. As I was winding up my career in the Department of Defense, I got a call out of the blue from a guy named Tom Wheeler, who I didn't know at the time, who said, hey, why don't you come on over and visit and have some coffee? He was the presumptive chairman at that time, waiting for his nomination to go through. And he indicated to me that he felt that the commission needed to do more to ensure that cyber threats didn't translate into market failure in the comm sector, to threats to public safety communications, to threat to the comm sector's obligation towards national security. And he wanted me to consider coming on board to be the bureau chief for public safety and homeland security, to among other things, raise the bar within the FCC for our understanding of cyber issues and our ability to be predictive and proactive regarding threats to the communication sector in that area. So without having done any particular job search up to that point, as I was the senior procurement executive for the Defense Information
Systems Agency. Oh, you couldn't say that.
I had a choice. I could either start recusing myself from things or, run through the end, and I chose to run through the end. So this just came in at the right time, and I have been very pleased with the decision to go back into the public sector.
That's great.
Love working for as exciting a leader as Tom Wheeler, who really, I think, accurately recognized threats in this area.
Well, and he gave a speech. I was there for that to talk about his agenda for cybersecurity, and it's pretty clear he had labored over that and felt strongly that he ought to do. That the commission ought to do more, and he name checked you, as I remember, and maybe Cleet, you as well. Put a lot of emphasis on what he was going to be expecting from you. He also created a bit of controversy, I guess I would say. He had a bunch of things that he wanted to do, and he said, I want this to be voluntary. I want it to be a new approach to regulation. I don't think the top-down, the prescriptive regs are going to work in this area. They'll be out of date in months. So we're going to challenge the industry to volunteer to do a better job. And I hope that works so I don't have to try something else. And then the question that immediately came from the Hill was, really, what is this something else of which you speak? let's start, I guess, with that. What is the basic approach that Chairman Wheeler is approaching? Is it truly voluntary, or is it voluntary assuming people actually do something that they ought to, and what are the alternatives if they don't?
Well, that's a great question, Stuart. There's a lot in there. I can tell you, first and foremost, we have an obligation to the public, to consumers, to citizens, to make sure that the communications are there when they're needed in our greatest emergencies. So there are aspects of the sector that just need to be organized in a way where it's not going to fail when they're needed. In many cases, the market is nicely responding to ensure that while we bring in new functionality with the internet protocol and the other new technologies in the space, we are protecting and providing the right degree of robustness and resiliency. But periodically, we continue to see indications that there are niche areas of the market that maybe don't have strong enough market forces looking after the security and resiliency of public safety and national security communications. So I think that's reflective of one size doesn't fit all. But the clear orientation of our approach is that the best posture for cybersecurity in the communications sector is when communications companies own the problem, when they recognize that these threats to their services not only potentially have a negative impact on consumers and on the public, but that they threaten the company as well. It threatens their bottom line if they don't get it right. Our position is that first and foremost, the improvement in cybersecurity need to be industry-led. They need to adopt the dynamism that's there in the market today And that's the best way to be agile against these threats, to allow the market to take the capitalization required to having recognized a threat, then generate the response to that threat. We believe that 95, 97, 90, you pick the large number percentage, can and will be the orientation for most of the threats that manifest themselves as we go forward. And our role then is just a facilitation of helping the different sectors of the industry see the threats they wouldn't otherwise see, to share between the subsectors, so that if the satellite guys are seeing something first, but it will ultimately have impact in cable, that we've got that right degree of communication going. But we recognize that there'll be situations where niche areas of the market either don't have sufficient competition to respond adequately, or are covering an area that you have such small players in that market that not all of them will necessarily do the right thing, because they just don't have the resources to capitalize. And I think that's the area, the 5% to 2%, where the FCC will not jump to prescriptive regulation for everyone, but work with the industry to address the phenomena that has led the smaller percentage areas to step up and do the right thing.
So when I was at DHS and we were doing a variety of industry nudging on security issues, not just cybersecurity issues, we had a rough 80% rule that if you went to the bigger players and you ask them to come up with best practices and tell you what they were doing, what they thought they should be doing, you'd come up with something that 80% of the industry followed already and saw as best practices, and then you would have as much as 20% of the industry that, for one reason or another, they're in a bad competitive hole, or they don't care, nobody's making them, so they're not going to do it. That 20% was the problem that we worked on, and we might even adopt regulations that said you have to pursue best practices. And right now, best practices are what the 80% are doing, and that means the 20% are regulated in a sense.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And DHS doesn't have a lot of regulatory leverage over communication companies,
no.
But through contracts and things like that, certainly has a significant influence. But I think the same concept applies here. But instead of going immediately to a regulatory solution, working with the 80%, as you put it, that are getting it right, and have them recognize that the 20% impacts them.
Right.
That risk shared by one is ultimately risk shared by all in many aspects of the internet, and that we first look to identify what are the barriers for the 20%, and mm-hmm. is there something, a solution that the 80% can bring over to help the 20% get after it? Is there something that we can do to help structure that 20% in a different way, so that as they interface with the 80%, we're not putting the 80% at risk? And in the last possible method, if we have to do something like increase the assessment and the information sharing of the 20% with the FCC, that there are all sorts of incremental steps that we can take to ensure that the spotlight is on that 20% in a measured way to help bring them into a threshold that ensures that consumers aren't put at risk and that competition is preserved, that we don't back away from universal access, and that public safety is never put at risk because, well, the company was just too small to pay for something like cybersecurity.
Well, I'll put Cleet on the spot with this question. It seems to me one of the things the FCC offers in that context where you're talking, what are the 80% doing? What's the best practices and how do we get the other 20% to do something like it? One of the problems that industry would have doing that would be worries about antitrust liability. And when the FCC convenes a group to ask that question, the likelihood of antitrust liability is, if not quite zero, very close to zero.
It's very clear what the goal of this convening is. It's not to collude for price-raising purposes. So I think that does significantly take care of that concern. Just to foot stomp something Admiral Simpson said about the way we see this and the whole new paradigm approach, it's premised on ownership of security at the owner-operator level, which is inherently proactive. It is the company that owns the network, that knows the network, that knows what's on the network, knows the threats to that network. That company and its executives from the IT department on up to the board and the CEO, that company owns the security of that network. And so it leans into it proactively the way it does every other aspect of its business. The way it leans into financial risk. It's not a checklist that you go down and you say, if I do this with regard to loans and investments, I'm safe financially. You're never safe. There's always a risk. And so the key principle that's built into this new paradigm is proactivity and at the owner-operator level, leaning into the risk. What that means with regard to voluntary, this is something Admiral Simpson went into some detail on last week at our CISRIC, or the FACA committee meeting. What does voluntary mean in that setting? It does not mean sort of the passive voluntary of nobody's making me do this. Nobody's making me secure my networks.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, out of sight, out of mind. If I feel like it, I'll do it. But if I don't feel like it, no big deal.
And what I just hope I won't fail.
Yeah. What voluntary means is you secure your networks because you know you need to. And you want to. So you're not doing it because the government's making you do it. You're doing it because your bottom line depends on it.
So the or else is not, or else the FCC will be on my case. The or else is I'll be out of business.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. But there's a very important corollary to that, and that's around measurement. That you've got to be able to measure the risk. You establish the internal controls, but you've got to communicate that in a way that doesn't just make sense to your boardroom. At some point, you've got to communicate aspects of that accepted cyber risk up to the FCC and to other regulatory entities who are charged with ensuring that for the public, that they're a company doesn't bite off too much and accept too much risk without being transparent about it. So there's an inherent measurement element to that.
So let me push on that because I'm a firm believer that you don't know how much risk you're taking on until you know who wants your stuff. The hacktivists, Anonymous and the like, are sometimes better than script kiddies, but often not. There's a risk there, but it's a script kiddie risk by and large. If you can't get in with Metasploit, there's a good chance that they aren't going to get into your system. But if it's the People's Liberation Army, they're much, at least more persistent and often better armed than Anonymous. And so knowing how worried you should be about certain kinds of risks really requires that you know whether the PLA is interested in getting into your network or not. So that strikes me as something that the government, not necessarily the FCC, but the government actually has data on. They have a better idea what the PLA wants than most private sector enterprises. Not all, but most. What is the FCC doing about getting information like that out of the U.S. government agencies that have it and into the hands of the people who have to evaluate risk?
Well, I'm going to first take issue with your premise, Stuart,
right,
that the government would know better about what other entities would want from a given company.
Jeez, I hope so. not what they want to steal.
Information has value, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's the information associated with intellectual property for a firm, it's not just other governments that are going to want that.
That's true.
It's your competitor down the street who, if they had a chance to maybe get a bump up, they would. It's the kids that share music that figured out that, hey, I can get this stuff for free on the internet. And to transfer the responsibility for premier ability to identify who wants your stuff,
right,
to government, to me, is proscript for failure.
I take your point. You know, for example, I mean, it's certainly Visa knows more about Eastern European credit card cyber thieves than the U.S. government does, because they care more. On the other hand, I certainly hope that our intelligence community knows more about the goals and methods of the People's Liberation Army or the Syrian Electronic Army than the private sector does, because they should care more about that.
Sure. But as you know, better than most, the intelligence community is a finite resource.
Right.
And they could only cover so many things. And they're going to cover what has greatest potential harm to the United States overall. And there are areas that just aren't covered because
right. mm-hmm.
It's a finite element. And that means a very significant information that has real value to organizations won't be looked after from threat actors are going after that stuff by the U.S. government, which is why I think you're seeing the emergence of companies like Mandiant
right.
that can provide tailored threat information for individual sectors and individual companies and large corporations. You're seeing them develop more of an intelligence-like function within their cyber defense structures as well. So you're absolutely right that you first got to figure out what do I have that others may want, and two, who are those others?
Right.
But it's not just the
government. I agree with that. Although I think the government probably on some of these things, especially the things that are really existential threats to a particular sector or network, the government ought to be in the position of being able to say, what, you didn't even think about this risk? That's crazy. We know there's a risk there.
Yeah, but let's talk about the other part where government can be helpful, because I think that people automatically understand the role of the intelligence community being helped with that larger problem. But that once a company knows it's been harmed, the ability to attribute that harm to, well, who was the perpetrator,
mm-hmm.
And then the ability to do something about it really requires more thought. We have to be able to, if we're going to be successful against organized crime in this arena, be able to have that attribution be meaningful within the law enforcement and all the way to prosecution part of our government. As companies organize, it's one reason why we are such fans of the NIST cybersecurity framework, because it ensures that companies divide up the different parts of the kill chain, if
uh-huh.
you will, to include, respond, and recover in a disciplined way, so that when you do have that aha moment and your company finds that this was the group trying to steal my stuff, and here's how I know that, there can be a satisfactory outcome from sharing that with government.
So the NIST framework is I know it's unfashionable to say nice things about checklists, but it is a checklist. It's a list of things that you ought to do. It doesn't tell you exactly how to do them. It doesn't tell you how aggressively to do them. But it's a list of things that you should not forget. And I think you, as you pointed out, Admiral, there's real value in making sure that you don't forget recovery. But it doesn't tell you exactly what to do. So getting everybody to adopt it is getting everybody to use the same vocabulary. It doesn't actually mean that they'll be singing the same song.
Yeah, so in that regard, to me, it's not a checklist. It's a taxonomy, right? If you want to call it a checklist, then call general accounting principles a checklist.
Right.
Well, try passing an audit just using GAAP, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to get into your programs and understand your internal controls for those programs and develop the details for that for your own company's mix of what it is you make or provide or serve. And how you're organized to do that. In that same regard, I think the cybersecurity framework just gives a broad taxonomy, a broad organization that allows companies to have a more meaningful company-to-company exchange of accepted risk so that they can ensure in those transactions that somebody's covering the gap. And sector to sector, we can improve upon the communication of risk between the banking sector and the communication sector to ensure that we know where the gaps are and that we're looking for areas to make both more successful by looking at options that would mitigate risk, mm-hmm. not in silos, but together.
So thinking about doing that, we talked before the show about the differences in approach between the financial sector and the telecom sector. The telecom sector is a provider to the financial sector, and there are some tensions there. There certainly have been some issues arising out of the DDoS attacks on U.S. banks, I continue to be astonished that DDoS attacks are still as successful as they are in this day and age, and that we haven't, in many cases, taken the steps that are necessary to make them much less successful. We're still patching together stuff. My question for you is, what concretely, because I know this is a focus of the CISREC. CISREC stands for the Cybersecurity.
It's the Communication Security Reliability and Interoperability Council. It's a beautiful five-letter acronym.
I have to say CISCI. The CISREC is looking at this. Is there something transformative or truly comforting that's likely to come out of the CISREC taking a look at DDoS attacks?
Well, that's a great question. And I think if you look at DDoS and say, oh, that was last year's threat vector, it's like looking at the flu and saying, mm-hmm. oh, well, that was last year's flu. Well, every year there's a different strain.
No, and they find new ways to magnify their signals.
Absolutely. So the use of distributed denial of service as part and parcel with other kinds of attacks has such utility that it will continue to morph in overwhelming aspects of the flow of information in and around enterprises. So that I don't think you're ever going to see us completely inoculate against DDoS as a problem for any one sector.
But the denial of service signals have to come from someplace.
Sure.
They have an address. It ought to be possible to determine their address and either filter them out along the way at the recipient's level or at source. If you're quick enough about sharing the information about who's actually making the attacks, and that's what I'm puzzled by, is that we don't seem yet to have a mechanism for actually identifying the source of these attacks and quickly suppressing them.
Yeah, so first let me agree with you on that part, that where the IP addresses can be identified. You know, the banks are looking at that transaction window, right? That 1 hour when all the banks are going to pass money back and forth to make sure that the end of the day is reconciled. Well, that's a very vulnerable time for the banks. The smaller banks present their credentials to larger banks and say, hey, transfer this money into my account. And if they see DDoS begin to overwhelm their systems in a way that's going to force them to shift to a route that may not be as protected as the other routes, or to expose credential certificates in the authentication piece, then it's a high risk time for them. When they see the distributed denial of service begin to come from IP addresses, they would very much like to have the ISPs help them block that, not just at the boundary of the bank, but at the boundary of the first time that the originating IP address is paired up with the IP address of the bank.
And what's the problem from the telecommunications provider's point of view in doing that? Is it a fear that they will cut off legitimate communications by legitimate customers?
That's one of the fears expressed, that it would run afoul of the anti-blocking rules.
But that's something the commission can fix.
Yes, and I think that if we well, first of all, this is happening to an increasing degree with individual banks and their ISPs. What the banks would like, however, is to be able to say, if one bank identifies the bad IP addresses, then can't we express that to the FSISAC and have the FSISAC say, oh, yeah.
Drop it into STLSA and send it on.
That, that really applies to all the banks.
And
not just one ISP, but all the ISPs should be able to take that action. And I think if we could come up with the right modality that would allow what today is possible with a bank asking their ISP to conduct that blocking for them, just for them, not for everywhere else in the ecosystem that might need that IP address, but that if we can come up with a modality that would say the FSISAC can validate the need for the entire banking sector and express that in a way that the communication ISAC or ISAC equivalent, so that all of the ISPs can, in fact, do something on behalf of the banks for the banks. I think there's something near term that we could potentially do there that would be a baby step that would help illuminate, well, just what exactly are the liability concerns, and do we have existing authorities by which we can mitigate those around specific use cases?
Yeah, that would certainly be useful. And if I remember right, you put everybody on a one-year deadline, and we're halfway to it, right?
Yes, we did say get hot.
Okay.
And it's very important. But we have seen great engagement from the sector, and we're really proud of the work that Brian Allen and Robert Mayer are doing in Working Group 4 of the CSRC, as well as our Working Group 5 that looked heavily at that DDoS issue and came up with some very specific next steps in that use case that we just went through.
Including specifically regarding information sharing.
Okay. And telecommunications has a special information sharing problem when the government gets involved because of their restrictions under ECPA, which they can't provide information to the government or certain kinds of information.
Certain kinds of information.
Right. Account information, I guess, without a subpoena, which makes it's a little sort of slows your information sharing down if you have to say, go fish, go get a subpoena for me.
But if you build this early in the process, right, and commit to things like anonymize as soon as you can in the process,
right.
I really think, and our engagement with the CSRC seems to suggest that there's some constructive things that we can do today with this.
And that's where the STIX and TAXI protocol that Navarro mentioned before can be really helpful because it can be, it's a structured, automated way to anonymize, even beyond PII, to anonymize company data.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the CSRG working group that's working on the server-side DDoS attacks put out 6 recommendations. They're public now. 3 of them pertain to information sharing, and 1 of them was specifically use protocols like STIX in order to share more information more quickly.
Okay.
In a way that doesn't run afoul of some of these potential legal barriers.
That would be a great idea if we can do that. Look, I don't want to hold you guys up. We had a whole bunch of legal issues that we were going to talk about for Cleet this off the hook.
I'm so sad about that.
My one other question for the Public Safety Bureau is, it's pretty new, and do you have to be an admiral to be the head of the Public Safety Bureau?
No, it's about a 50-50 chance.
Okay. thank you, Admiral Simpson. This was terrific. Cleet Johnson, this was a great discussion. Before we sign off, we'd like to give people an opportunity to plug the events that they think our listeners ought to be focused on. So if there's something that you're doing, a speech you're giving, a report you're issuing that people should be watching for, this is your opportunity.
Well, I think there are a couple of key things. And first, you know, being an admiral, that does allow you to have a certain degree of utility in and around rocks and shoals. And I found that to be very helpful in this job, at least attempting to steer around the rocks and shoals. But one of the things we've got coming up is a concern that we have in the increased scale associated with outages across the country. And in April of this year, there was an outage to 911 that impacted, that denied 911 service to 7 states for 6.5 hours.
Oof.
Huge. And if you can imagine, there's one example of a woman in her home who had a home intruder. She was on the second floor. She called 41 times to 911. It could never got through. That's a bad day. And it was a sunny day as far as disasters. There was no disaster that caused it. It was a failure in a particular system. In the October open meeting we just announced in the agenda, we'll be providing the report out of the causative factors for that large multi-state outage and the implications that we're concerned about, that this increasingly interconnected world, which is great, brings in new functionality, mm-hmm. that if we're not really careful with our private sector partners here, we will be great with new functionality, but we'll have used...
The old functionality might not be there.
Well, we'll have used the what's possible in the Internet protocol to just lower costs.
Right.
And not address resiliency and robustness. So I think that's a key thing that we've got coming up in October. Stay tuned for that.
All right.
We're also excited about text 911 and the increased capability that we're seeing with that. A part of the order, though, to implement text 911 included a task to us to do a study around optimizing public safety answering points, the 911 call centers.
Right.
So we're applying to establish a FACA for that this week to make sure that we can work with our partners in the states and communities to ensure that as we go to next generation 911, everything over IP, that we're doing that responsibly and in a way that's efficient for not just the operation of PSAPs, but for the defense of those PSAPs.
So let me lobby you on that. When I was in government, I was enthusiastic after things like Katrina about people being able to text their particular emergency situations, because of course that gets through much faster and much better than phone calls when you've got limited bandwidth. And because the PSAPs were kind of not exactly rushing to handle those, my suggested solution was give people the option of publishing them. Put them on a publicly available website and let people crowdsource the priorities.
Yeah, great idea, we have that now on our website. We essentially have the matrix of the PSAPs that right. either have the capability or have applied for the capability. And in our annual report that we have to submit to Congress, that where we pull together what is it that the states did with their E-911 funds, we will in the future identify those the penetration rate, if you will, of text to 911 for the states, so that citizens can correlate what did they do with those funds? Did they put them towards 911? And what effect did those states get? Did they actually get PSAPs that are text capable?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because my uninformed impression is that there's a lot of money going in and not a lot of functionality coming out, and the PSAPs may be just keeping a lot of this, or the local governments may be keeping a lot of the money for other
products. I guarantee you the PSAPs aren't.
Right. Okay. But the governments get a fair amount of money out of this.
They do. In last year's report, four states used E-911 funds for something else. Those four states are taking action this year.
Oh, good.
And that's a decreased number. So every right. year we've done the report, more and more states are beginning to do the right thing with their 911 funds. But this is a tricky time as we go forward with not just Next Generation 911, but with FirstNet, and determining what's the right priority of that spend is not a trivial task. So I don't want to suggest that the state job is easy.
Right. And, Cleet, you got any speeches coming up?
Well, we have the benefit of lots of invitations for great discussions like this, and I think you'll probably see us popping up from time
All
to
right.
time.
All right, good.
But, we are, as you said, we're at the halfway mark with regard to really that central effort, which is the framework implementation. It's not the only effort, and it's one that is helping drive a lot of the others.
So are we
going to
are we going to see something specific come out in 6 months when the deadline arrives?
Traditionally, the all of the working groups of the CSRC issue a public report
okay.
at the end, and that will be the
And that's a good point. You can expect to see us at RSA.
Okay.
Just after the March report out of the
CSRC. Oh, okay.
And so we will want to, with the cyber professionals there, really understand the did we get something meaningful out of this, or did we just get a bunch of talk but no action?
You ought to go to Black Hat, and they'll tell you for sure.
That's right. You know, Stuart, let me add one more item to the future speaking engagements. Mm-hmm. I am headed up in October to the University of Connecticut, and I'll be joined by Erica Olson, who's the counsel on my staff that is leading the cyber workforce part of our portfolio. And she's specifically looking at the cyber workforce that supports the commercial communication sector. And, you know, it is so important, yet often so overlooked. Over 90% in DOD, it was 95% of our cyber bill every year was workforce.
Yes.
And across the commercial sector, what I've seen is that is the greatest degree of variability, and really quite often distinguishes between companies that proactively do the right thing and mm-hmm. don't have a successful attack against them, and companies that wake up the next day and say, huh? Outsourcing that particular analysis function to Pakistan wasn't a good idea, to a company in Pakistan. At the University of Connecticut, I'll be talking with their students and faculty in their cyber academic center of excellence to help continue to have a broad-based approach towards improving the ability of the workforce in the communication sector to do what we've asked the comm sector to do, to step up, increase their professionalism, increase their ability to hold cyber professionals accountable, mm-hmm. And get after this nation's challenge.
It makes sense, although my sense is that carriers are know less and less about their infrastructure because, you know, there's a mismatch between what the engineers grew up with and what they're now running. So it's going to be tough for them. And I will cite a Brown student that I met a few years ago who had done some wonderful cyber security research. I had a cup of coffee with him up in Providence, and he said something that I've always held with me. He said, you know, in this field, you're either self-taught or you aren't any good. And that is true, because the fact is you have to re-self-teach yourself every year what the threats are, what the solutions are, what you need to do. So professionalizing is great, but the real problem here is kind of continuing professional education and finding people who are going to challenge themselves every day to learn something new about the threat.
Well, that latter point is exactly right. There's a lot of similarities here with kids that are good as gamers, right? Because you have a thinking adversary that for every move you're going to make, they're going to do a counter move. So it's not just good enough to have some Ivy League academic, unless you identify, instill, and continue to cultivate that gaming sense of I need to react and think what that adversary is going to do, then I don't care how many classes you sit through, how many tests you pass, you're not going to be an effective cyber professional. But that doesn't mean, I think, that we can't bring significant professional structure into this sense, so that we can, as a minimum, begin to identify those that succeed and do well in this space and those that just go from company to company to company and are themselves a rolling threat factor.
Sort of like baseball managers. Okay. My upcoming engagements, I'm doing a debate over the constitutionality of mass collection of telecom data next week in Philadelphia for Intelligence Squared, and then we'll be in both Minneapolis and St. Paul around the 16th and 17th talking to two cybersecurity conferences. This has been Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast. We are now, for those of you who want to leave feedback, by email, cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. Or if you'd like to leave us a message, if it's really entertainingly abusive or insightful, we will play it on the air, 1-202-862-5785. Just leave a message at the tone. And as I said, this has been the episode 36 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week when we will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.